Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Kasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Kasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
All right, welcome to Think Big with Dan and Kasim, and we have Mateen filling in for Kasim today, and our guest today is David Miller. So David, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us where you live and what you do for a living.
Yeah, so my name is David Paul Miller. I always added the Paul for personal branding. David Miller is so common. Mm-hmm. David Paul Miller, a little bit less common, and then buyers started calling me DPM about 7 years ago. So I just rolled and leaned into that. If you noticed, I connected with you on LinkedIn. It's just DPM. And it's like a, I don't know, personal branding thing. I live in Charleston, South Carolina, which is where my brands are based, the New Primal and Noble Made. I am the CSO for the company.
Awesome. So how did you become a founder? Like, how did you get this idea to, you know, start these companies?
So Jason Burke is actually our true founder. He's the one that started making jerky on his kitchen counter. And it's a founder story that I think parallels a lot of founder stories. We were all early adopters of CrossFit. I went to Ohio State and I did not know what I wanted to do after that. And so I was actually a firefighter for a few years. I had a friend who was a firefighter here, and he basically said, while you figure out what you want to be when you grow up, why don't you come down here and do that? And I was like, I don't know. He's like, you get paid to work out. You only work 2 days a week. I was like, I mean, that sounds pretty good to a 22, 23 year old. Right. And so I was doing that. And early on, CrossFit was essentially only police, military, and firefighters. That was kind of what it was initially designed for. We're talking like 2007. This is like pretty far back, right? Before it was really a household thing. And so I fell in love with it. Like, I was a three-sport athlete growing up, and it was a way to take competition kind of into adulthood, because you can't really play football all the time. And basketball, yeah, you know, you play pickup games. Baseball doesn't really translate to adulthood outside of maybe a softball beer league type situation. And the paleo diet is so closely tied to CrossFit. I started eating paleo, and I was like, oh my God, because, you know, coming out of college, pizza and beer, a lot of that. And so, you know, you're young enough, you can kind of get away with it. But I kind of started to think, you know, probably not something I want to do forever. I should probably, you know, eat a little healthier, learn a little bit more about nutrition. And then I was living in New Jersey and working in New York, still doing CrossFit, training CrossFit. And Jason Burke was a friend of a friend. And a friend reached out and said, hey, I don't know if you heard about this. There's a guy in Charleston who's making grass-fed, grass-finished jerky. And I was like, no, but that's awesome. I mean, this is like 2009, 2010. And so I actually reached out to Jason. I was like, this is really cool what you're doing. I think it's going to be huge. I was like, I've been doing this since 2007. And I think it's scratching the surface of what it's going to be. And luckily, we were right in hindsight. But we kind of just stayed in touch over the next couple of years. And I was actually working in estate planning. Really, really exciting stuff. And I kind of knew that I didn't really want that to be the rest of my life, right? It was lucrative. And, you know, it was kind of fun in some ways. Got to hang out and meet a lot of great people. But I wanted something that I was passionate about, right? And health and wellness and fitness was definitely that. But going back to Jason and why he started making jerky, he was working in an office software sales job. And had started to put on a little weight, wasn't feeling too great. And so he was like, I need to start working out. He found CrossFit, he found paleo. It's kind of like the same as the formula for a lot of people. And he started batch cooking. He was making his meals, just crushing it, right? Doing his workouts, making his meals. But it was at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon that like you start to get a little tired, you need a little pick-me-up, a snack. And so he had a vending machine about 15 feet away from his desk. Jason also has a sweet tooth. Bad combination, right? If you're working that office desk and you're trying to lose weight, he's like, I got to get away from that. He started doing raw almonds and cashews. two problems. One, it's very boring after a while. And two, super calorically dense. If you're trying to drop some pounds, you know, almonds and cashews aren't going to be your best friend unless you have really good willpower and you're only doing a very small amount. So he thought jerky would be the answer to what he was looking for. High protein, low sugar, you know, no junk, except when he looked at what was in the market, that actually wasn't the case. He wanted grass-fed, grass-finished beef. He wanted no canola oil. He wanted no soy. He wanted no added sugar. And that just absolutely did not exist. We're talking like 2011, 2012 now. So he literally Googled how to make beef jerky, had never made it in his life, didn't come from a real culinary background. His mother, that can come later, an incredible cook, but he never done that before. And what he found was the way that you would grill a steak or marinate a steak did not translate perfectly to jerky. Everything intensifies and it's a completely different process, right? So his first few attempts were not good, barely edible, I think, if you ask him. But he was buying grass-fed, grass-finished beef. That stuff, it's still expensive. But back then, there was basically no supply. And so you'd have to like really source it. And it was very expensive. So he was still going to, you know, choke it down, even if it was terrible. He kept at it and he kind of figured out and played with flavor profiles and figuring out what worked and what didn't work. Eventually, he got good at it. It was like a 7-8 month process. And people started to actually leave money on his desk at work. Next time you make a batch, will you make me like literally like a Ziploc bag full, right? That continued. And eventually he had 60 hydrators going on his kitchen counter. His wife goes out for a girls' night out. She comes back and she's kind of upset. And his wife, Kristen, is like one of the sweetest people you'd ever meet. Her friends had teased her the entire night, asking her if she'd gotten a part-time job at a barbecue shop. In Charleston, because their hair, their clothes, like everything in their house smelled like beef and smoke at that point, because he just constantly had these dehydrators going. So she said, you got to get this out of here. So he had a friend who actually is a restaurateur here in Charleston who had a catering business. So he already had like DHEC approval and all he had to do was get USDA to come in. And that was kind of the start of everything. And so I'll skip a couple parts. We basically all quit our jobs and said, we're going to figure out how to do this. And just jumped in gung-ho, not coming from the industry, blind ambition, essentially, is what kind of led us all into this.
That's really cool. So what was your biggest challenge in starting this company?
Biggest challenge? Like I said, none of us came from CPG or grocery. So we have paid for our education time and time again. We always joke that if we knew how capital intensive this whole thing was, we're not sure if we would have actually gotten into it, because it is far more capital intensive than I think a lot of people realize when they start their company. I think early on, it was just lack of connections. We didn't know anyone. You know, we didn't know how distributor relationships worked. We didn't know how broker relationships worked. We didn't know what chargebacks were. We had no idea like marketing expectations. So we were literally learning as we went. In the early days, Jason and I, we actually used a website. I don't even know if it's still up. It was called organicstorelocator.com. And they had a map. And we would each pick a state. And we would just roll through every. And these were like indies and co-ops, like mom and pop type shops. And we would just cold email these accounts, telling them what we were doing with just enthusiasm and excitement. We were the only people making grass-fed, grass-finished beef jerky, though. So we did have a unique that is no longer unique. There are a lot of brands out there. We actually hoped for that to happen because we think it's, you know, better for the environment, better for the animals, which is a huge piece of why we do what we do. But it was like, it was the least sexy thing ever. I mean, just cold emails. Most people aren't going to respond. A lot of them didn't even have email addresses. They had Facebook pages. And so we were sending them cold Facebook messages from our personal accounts. These are the stories that I feel like a lot of times you don't hear about the startup world and, the true grind of the early days. So we would do that in the morning and then literally scrub in hair nets, aprons, and be weighing and packaging jerky, running it through a heat sealer. So I think the early days was just, it was the lack of experience, lack of connection, and honestly, just the lack of understanding exactly how the industry worked. Shortly thereafter, we went to a show called Outdoor Retailer in Salt Lake City, and we met a guy named Justin Gold. If you know Justin's Nut Butter, and Justin was super nice. We connected with him right away, like great vibes. And he really helped us kind of avoid a lot of pitfalls and hurdles that I think slowed him obviously he did just fine. But the things that kind of like slowed him down a little bit, he was able to pass on to us. And actually a couple of the calls that I was on today were talking in younger brands. And so we try to pay it forward and help even the things that maybe slowed us, or, you know, we try to go wide. That was one of the things. I was going to every retailer, and it's like, it's very much a be careful what you wish for type situation, because I was getting a lot of yes. And we were a tiny team that was bootstrapped and had no marketing budget. I don't think we didn't know if refills were a thing at the time or slotting. And so that was another piece of it, was that I mentioned capital intensive nature. We were getting a lot of yes, but if I could go back in time, I would have slowed down and gone deep with a few key relationships.
So David, what's the role of technology in your business right now?
Role of technology? Basically everything. I mean, I live my entire life on it. If I'm not sitting in front of a buyer in a meeting, I'm on either my computer at my office or my laptop at home or somewhere out on the road. Honestly, there's no end to it. I mean, AI has become really important, I think, for a lot of what we're doing over the past 6 months to a year, at least for me. I'm using a lot of that. And you know, I think a lot of people are afraid of it, but I'm like, the genie's not going back in the bottle. That doesn't happen. So I think you either embrace it and you get really good at it. I think a lot of people are afraid it's going to take their job. My belief is that someone who's good at it might take your job, but it itself won't likely take your job. So we'll see where that goes. But I mean, from the way POs are submitted in the industry through EDI down to the portals that all the retailers have, you know, there's really no end to it. And I think it's a constant search to find an optimized platform. It's just like branding. It's like every time we move to a new piece of branding or we have an adjustment, we look back and we were like, God, how did we ever think that was good? Right. But it's just like a constant, like getting better. And I think technology is the same way. You kind of have to audit it at regular intervals and make sure there's not something better, more affordable, more optimized, whatever the case may be.
Awesome. So in terms of AI, like how specifically, you mentioned a few different things, you know, EDIs and POs, but how specifically do you think they can really help your business like in the next year or two?
That's a great question. I mean, I embraced it early. I've told people who haven't maybe like gotten into it yet, like if you're good at Googling, you can get good at AI prompts. I mean, it's kind of like a similar idea, right? If you're good at Googling, you know the exact words to put in to get the desired result. And if you're not great at it, it's probably going to take you quite a bit longer. As far as like moving forward, I mean, I could speculate. I think it's only going to get more important. I think it's only going to get more vast in the applications. I mean, I've even seen that like recently. There's a Twitter account that I follow that does a really good job of, I think there's even a website. It's called There's an AI for That. Have you guys seen that? That like keeps a constant update of like whatever you're trying to do. And it's just growing at this incredible rate where, you know, if there's something you're trying to do, I just saw one the other day that you could install. It's a Google Chrome extension and it can read empathy and word counts. It can count like how many times words come up in a meeting with your team. It can gauge anger, fear, trepidation. Like it's pretty like wild stuff. And I'm not a huge tech guy again, but I can definitely nerd out on a lot of that stuff. Cause I think it's, you know, people use that saying we're living in the future. This is kind of one of the first things that I feel like actually feels like that. It's an overused term, but this one feels very much like that. It feels like as big as the internet itself. It's the first thing I feel like that has come around that feels as big as the birth of the actual internet itself, or the internet boom, at least.
So what makes you better than your competition?
I have a very, at least my selling style. I never say I'm better or that we're better or that our products are better. I mean, as a consumer, I think our products are better. As the head of sales of the brand, when I walk through the door of a category review meeting, I check my ego at the door. I come from a full on place of servitude. I'm talking to a buyer. If you're my buyer, my job is to help you win. And how do you win? You win by growing the category. You win by getting accolades. You win by getting promotions. bonuses. Those are the things that, you know, I think actually matter when you, when you're looking to do that. Because at the end of the day, the vast majority of them, possibly all of them, they don't care about your brand or your products really at all. I mean, they're just looking at these are basically numbers in a spreadsheet, and how can I gap fill? We have a line called Snackmates. It is the first kids meat snack to be nationally distributed around the US. It's in the meat snack section, and it is in everywhere from Whole Foods and Sprouts to Walmart. And so this has a really, really big crossover appeal. What we found is a lot of parents, even if they don't eat all that healthy themselves, they do tend to try to look for better for you items for their kids when they can. And I mean, again, that's a huge piece of what we do. If it's better for the environment, we're going to be into it. Like, we use regenerative farming practices in our sourcing, grass-fed, grass-finished beef only. You know, that kids line I mentioned, we took them out of a bag recently and cut down on plastics by 41%. So it's really a holistic kind of ethos of the brand of better for you nutrition, better animal welfare. We've never used concentrated animal farming operations. We never would. There are some brands who started that way and then kind of saw where the dollars were going and went that way. So whether it was altruistic or not, if it moves things in a better way as a whole, we think it's going to be a great thing. But, you know, flavor profile, I guess, would be my answer of what makes us better. You know, I'm old enough. I remember in the 90s, you could basically package cardboard and it would sell in a place like Whole Foods or Sprouts or something like that, because competition just wasn't there. If you wanted to eat healthy and you wanted to buy things that had a certain call out or certain macros or calories, there weren't options. You were just going to have to deal with the fact that you're cutting out flavor for a healthier option. That's no longer the case. Everything is incredibly, incredibly competitive. And so actually the last call I was on, it was a very, very, very traditional, old school. And the guy was like, I don't know, I feel like you guys are like very Whole Foods, right? I was like, we are, but forget all of that. I put our flavor profile up against anything in the market. And I think it holds its own, if not beating everything out there. And I think that's how you can win the next gen consumer. The millennials and Gen Z, particularly millennials, I'm a Zennial actually, that weird like little crossover spot. I think people love nostalgia. We want the things that we grew up with, but we're smart enough now to know, you know, maybe the Slim Jim wasn't the best thing, or maybe the Lunchable isn't so great. That doesn't mean the idea isn't great, right? It just means the offerings. And so I think that not reinventing the wheel, just cleaning things up, providing or sourcing from higher quality proteins, higher quality ingredients. I mean, you don't really have to do that much. Some of the ingredients we put in the US, especially corn syrup solids, high fructose corn syrup in everything, soy in everything, canola oil in everything. It doesn't have to be that way. And it's a greed thing. I mean, there's no way around it. It is a greed thing. Those are very, very cheap ingredients. And then, you know, margins go up. So we're definitely fighting in an uphill battle, but we have a lot of great brands and a lot of great people that are on fighting the battle with us.
That's awesome. So what is your top priority in the next 3 to 6 months?
Oh man, we're going fairly short term. 3 to 6 months feels like it's like gone in the blink of an eye, right? Next 3 to 6 months. So we're going into what for me is generally the busiest category review season. I am headed to 4 cities, but have 5 major category reviews the week of the 21st. And then that kind of sets up the beginning of next year. And so it's always funny, like each different team, like marketing is living in the now, right? And ops kind of is. They're maybe a month or two out. Like I'm living like a year or at least 8 months in the future at seemingly all times, because it depends on, you know, when they're reviewing the category and when it resets. And the bigger they are, typically the longer time to the reset. And so I guess for me over the next certainly 3 months is knocking some of these reviews out of the park, finding ways that we can help those buyers grow the category, the items that make sense to plug into the set for them. And then it gets really quiet in November, December, because everyone's just like our grocery partners, especially they're holding on for dear life. They're getting through Thanksgiving. They're getting through Christmas. And then there's another big boom in January when everyone says New Year, New Me. I'm going to go to the gym for, you know, 2.5 months or whatever it ends up being. But January tends to be a really big one for us. And then the kids line snack mates. Back to school, of course, is the biggest spike. January is actually another big spike because it's like a mini back to school. Kids have been home for a holiday break. And so those are kind of, I guess over the next 6 months, those are kind of the key pieces.
Well, so if we're going to have this conversation again in 1 year from now, so you mentioned 1 year, what would that look like for you and for your brands?
Depends on how well I do in these meetings coming up. No, I mean, we've said for a long time, we're in our 10th year now. As long as we're still having fun, we should keep doing it, right? The second we're not having fun anymore, I don't think it makes sense. I mean, the whole point, I think, of joining a startup or starting a startup is to be your own boss, right? And that's, you know, attractive to a lot of people, changing the world in some positive way. I mean, I'm not saying that we're, you know, I'm not certainly not pounding our chest saying that we're single-handedly doing it, but if we can be a small, you know, cog in the wheel of moving things in a better direction, I think that we can all be really proud of that. So I don't know, man, a year, I always want things to move faster than they tend to. That's just my nature. I want things to happen last month, last quarter. And sometimes it's just not the way it goes. So kind of just keeping the head down, man, focusing on the right demographic, the right retailers, people that understand what we're doing and why, and how we can help them grow. And luckily what we do has become so much more mainstream at this point than it was when we started. I mean, when we first started, you know, I like I said, I went too wide. I think we had a meeting with Sam's Club and we were like, I think 2 years in. And that's not a knock on Sam's Club. We just didn't know what we were doing. We had no business talking to Sam's Club, right, at that time. But now a lot of those conversations are occurring. We've had a few rotations with Costco. And a big piece, again, is bringing better-for-you options to the masses. And we think that we have quite a few products that can do that. And that can be, like I said, a cog in that wheel of moving things in a positive direction.
Awesome. So if somebody wanted to reach out to you or to your brand, what's the best way for somebody to get in contact with you?
With me personally, LinkedIn, DPM, pretty easy to find through that. The website has a contact us as well. And if you at this point, we have enough distribution pretty much anywhere you could find us. But there are some people who live in, you know, what we call the food deserts, where maybe they have hopefully food, but maybe not access to the better for you options or their price points that just don't work for a lot of families. And so Thrive Market has been a great partner of ours. We actually agreed to partner with them before they launched. My friend John Durant, who when I worked up in New Jersey, New York, he reached out to me when I moved back to Charleston. We were starting this thing. He's like, my friend from Harvard is starting this thing. It's going to be like Costco meets Whole Foods online. Would you guys be willing to talk to him? And I was like, yeah, I mean, like who are we? Like, we just started, right? And so it was actually, it's crazy to talk about now, because they're huge and they've done such an incredible job of doing the right things and also growing, right? Like it's not an easy thing to do, to not cut corners and be doing the right thing and committed to your mission and still grow. Like you still got to run a business. You still have to be profitable and you grow. And so they've been fantastic to work with, but, online, Amazon, Thrive, our own website, and our website has to contact us, if you wanted to reach out to us.
Awesome. Well, TPM, thank you so much for your time. We're rooting for you. Hopefully
you
can chat again in 1 year as you guys keep scaling and growing your business.
Yeah. Hopefully I'll have some exciting news for you guys.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks. All right. Bye.
Bye.